accessible vehicles. Nobody can say we don't have enough vehicles. A lot of them are SAT vehicles specifically designed to serve the Lyft contract and the medical transportation brokerages. So we like to put those vehicles in those fleets to preserve them for that type of service. When the fact of the matter is, the general passenger request for taxi cab service that are wheelchair fluctuates between about 1.3 and 2% of all our rides. So 98% at least or more of the rides that we're providing in that expensive vehicle, those vehicles cost about $50,000 compared to the maybe $18,000 or $20,000 we'll spend on a new Prius. So putting those trips in those vehicles doesn't really make sense. We need to at times, but we also need to limit it so we can preserve those vehicles for the kind of service they're needed for. So we did recently do a study, and what we determined is that when we looked at the price of the vehicle, the additional time it takes to assist the passenger in boarding and deboarding and in tying down their mobility device, when you take all that into account, every wheelchair accessible trip is subsidized by about in the neighborhood of like $33 to $34. And this works in the taxi industry because those rides are subsidized by all the other riders, and that works out to around 60 cents per trip on all the other trips, if that makes sense.
So what total cost does that add up to? Can you give like an annual cost for Wavia cab of the fact that you had to have wheelchair accessible vehicles?
I could come back with that. I can't do it off the top of my head.
So, Stephen, let me get...
By the way, that makes sense to me. I mean, I take the number 12 bus home, and it is designed to be able to pick people up who are in wheelchairs. It picks people up on bikes. The fare structure is designed to make sure it covers the cost of all riders, anybody that wants to get on that bus. And the fares and the subsidies are pegged to make sure it's accessible to everybody. It does seem difficult, though, to compensate you after the fact for investments you've made under one set of rules, which no longer apply to you or a competitor during another phase. And that I'm struggling with that a little bit, because whether one agrees or disagrees with the old regime, those were the ground rules, and you followed them and incurred expenses. It does seem to me that if we're creating, it reminds me of the idea of a level of a sort of a fair fight where, you know, you're at the starting line, burdened by a lot of costs and other legacy things, and someone else is liberated from that. We'll see who's faster. It does seem to me that a challenge we have is how do we compensate for the fact that you've had to incur costs under one system that someone else doesn't under a new system, and is that fair?
Well, I agree it isn't fair, and in fact, over the last few years, one of the ideas that Broadway's tried to implement is this notion that when we have been caught where the demand for accessible vehicles outweighs our supply, we've asked the city, can we please just use one of our non-emergency medical transportation, our SAT vehicles, to provide this ride? Isn't it better than making them wait? And the city has absolutely forbidden it. And now suddenly the task force comes up with it as a solution to the problems in this industry. So it is a little frustrating sometimes. I also would say, even if you do find these, even if you were able to find a non-emergency medical transportation company that had excess capacity and was willing to contract with the TNCs, none of them have the technology that the TNCs have. That passenger will experience a different level of service in that. They're not going to be able, at least I don't believe, they're going to be able to track the vehicle coming towards them. And those are the things that people really love, is being able to order without actually talking to anybody, do it instantaneously, and then watch the vehicle's progress so you know you're in the queue. And I don't think that'll be available if they contract out the service.
Mr. Mayor, these are exactly the kinds of detailed discussions that we should have been having in the task force. We were not able to, and that was the problem, the reason we're here raising all these technical issues
that
now.
Point. Let's suppose tomorrow we adopted a rule that simply says every taxi or TNC has to provide equivalent service to people who need wheelchair accessible vehicles to the service they provide those who don't. And we defined what equivalent means, and we had penalties for violations. And that applied to everybody. Would you argue that before adopting that rule for everybody and allowing everybody into the market, we'd have to wait for some period of time for you to recoup your investment in the accessible vehicles? And what amount of time would that be? Could it be 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, where we sort of freeze the market while you recoup your investment in those vehicles?
Well, we typically depreciate our vehicles over 5 years, and we did just purchase 10 new vehicles because the city expanded the number of permits available to us. So, and I know Green Cab just put in a purchase order for, I think it's, I don't know, $500,000 worth of vehicles. So I'm guessing that would be at least 5 years.
So you would suggest that if we announced that new rule that's divorced from percentage of fleet, then we should make that effective. We should not allow anybody to operate under the new rule until 5 years from now?
No, I'm saying that's how long it would likely take them to recoup their costs. I think we could find a creative solution that somehow, you know, it sometimes feels like the solutions we throw about are all or nothing. I think the key here is going to be finding those sweet spots in the middle where we can all function under the same rules without completely devastating any of the passengers that rely on this service.
Stephen, you've given us a big this is your packet.
Yes.
And I guess we understand the concerns you and your client are raising. Does this packet contain suggested amendments if the council decides to pursue this route, or does this just raise red flags?
We have a few in there. What we would like.
I mean, recognizing you don't like this approach, have you got specific ideas for improving it?
We do, and interestingly, Commissioner Fish, we met with the Lewis and Clark students, Ray and I did, for about an hour and a half the other day. And in that hour and a half, we produced a whole lot of really good stuff because we were able to, in an informal setting, back and forth it, and make suggestions and have those suggestions challenged on both sides. And we came up with some really good ideas. I think that we could, given a relatively short period of time and being in the same room, we could work out a system for the city of Portland that would work.
The Lewis and Clark law students recommended eliminating the cap on the number of participants and eliminating price regulations, as I recall. In your conversation, did they stick to that or did you change their minds?
We did not achieve resolution on that one issue. I guess my thought would be, you know, we don't have to do it all at once. Let's try it a step, try it a step, try it a step, and okay. Or at some point realize, okay, we've gone too far. Market conditions are horrible. Maybe we shouldn't go further. But it does take a lot of ongoing effort, and that's something, you know, that historically the city hasn't really been willing.
So I appreciate the chance for the council to probe into some of these issues with you. I appreciate the detailed testimony you provided. I want to give you just a minute or two to wrap up because we've got some other folks we need to hear from.
Yeah, could I ask just for them to go into the insurance piece because I know that's what you were just about to get to, and that's my main concern.
Okay. Stephen?
Thank you. I have a few comments on insurance. First, the present city code requires traditional taxi companies to name the city as an intentional additional insured. Now, I heard testimony from the task force that was in here. I didn't see it in the report. I would suggest that you check with your city risk management folks on that issue. Secondly, the Uber has cleverly snookered the task force on the issue of phase one coverage. They confused the task force on the difference between the risk of injury and severity of damages. The report calls for reduced, nearly meaninglessly, coverage limits during phase one, supposedly because of the reduced risk. Now, I don't want to debate whether there actually is a reduced risk or not, but reduced risk means you have a reduced premium. It doesn't mean you have a reduced coverage. For example, there are policies you can get that if you drive less than 10,000 miles a year, your insurance companies will reduce your premium. They don't reduce your coverage. If you hit somebody, you still get the big coverage. This is nonsense pulled out of Uber's corporate headquarters, and we got to put a stop on it right now. If somebody gets hurt before or after they pick up a passenger, that person who gets hurt shouldn't get one form of compensation at one time and another form of compensation another time. And yes, that's what the proposal is. That's just nuts. What we're doing, the second thing is this proposal calls for the individual drivers to be of TNCs to be holding the insurance. Again, this is nuts. Our companies have our own insurance policy. Each company has an insurance policy. Even those that have independent drivers who own their own cars, the company has the insurance policy. The thought that somehow Uber is going to have their individual drivers have their insurance company, try and enforce that. We have a difficulty at the City of Portland right now trying to enforce the individual certificates of insurance on our limousines And that's a relatively small number of people. You have 2,000 Uber drivers out there and Lyft drivers. Who's going to enforce that? We haven't had a real good record of enforcement on those kind of things. And, you know, if you have one person ending his coverage in July, another one ending his coverage in October, it's just an impossible a task. I have a bill in the legislature that we've been working on with Broadway that's working its way through, which I anticipate is going to pass, that says that the TNC is responsible app on to app off as a primary carrier. And I think anything less than that is irresponsible in the city of Portland. That's my summary.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Obviously appreciate your willingness to keep working on these issues. And thank you for more detailed testimony than you were able to cover in the time. So I do want to give the commissioner a chance to call some more invited testimony and then give some folks the chance
thank
to
you.
Comment as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, Steve, who do you have?
I think here? Darren Campbell's up next.
Okay. Afternoon.
Afternoon.
For the record, my name is Darren Campbell. I am the registered lobbyist for Radio Cab as per council rules. However, I also serve as the private hire transportation board driver representative, and that is going to be where I am coming from today. I do appreciate all the work that the task force has done. I've been on those types of groups before. It takes a great deal of personal sacrifice from family and job to be able to take on a project like that. So I do understand how much work they have put into it. However, I believe that that process was flawed from the beginning. The task force was created with no industry representation. It was had a lot of guidance from PBOT, which, as Commissioner Novick mentioned earlier, is a new overseer of the industry. Their experience in PBOT in regards to the private hire transportation industry is limited. And on top of that, the industry was untapped, if not just ignored, as to our expertise to lend guidance or help in any way. I believe Mr. Kefouri illustrated that quite well. The timeline that was given to the task force was extremely narrow. I think any time that you rush into something like this and put an extreme time limit or an end date, you're going to have conceptual issues. You're going to miss the mark, so to speak. And I'm hoping that some of the suggestions that have been brought forth today about looking outside the task force recommendations may be looked at strongly. I wanted to discuss the caps on the number of vehicles that are being suggested to go away. It creates an unfair playing field between the cab companies and the TNCs. The TNCs are able to put an unlimited number of vehicles on the road based on who signs up on their app and goes through the process, where for a cab company to do that, you know, obviously we have to buy a car, we have to find a driver, we have to invest a significant amount of money into marking it, putting the equipment into it, insuring it, and then putting it on the road. At the end of that 120-day period, where the TNC might just have to exclude some drivers, we're stuck with a potential number of vehicles that we then can't use for a while. The environmental impact, putting potential thousands of cars on the streets in downtown Portland on a weekend, we really don't know what the outcome of that is, but I can imagine it's going to be significant. Safety of pedestrian traffic, especially during the peak times when more vehicles are out, is problematic as well as far as safety to the people of Portland. And I do have a recommendation as to how to deal with a cap on a TNC. I believe that the TNCs will tell you, well, there's no way we can possibly limit the number of people that we have on the streets. And my answer to that is that you limit the number of people that can be engaged in the app at any given time. You allow that line to adjust during demand times. So if demand goes up, the allowance for more drivers for the TNC to log in would adjust as well. It would also make it easier to enforce some of the rules in regards to how many vehicles are out there to have a limited number. Instead of an astronomical number, I think enforcement would be a little bit easier. I did want to discuss the accessibility vehicles briefly. And I think in regards to this, we really need to think ahead. The Private Hire Transportation Board recently increased the number of permits drastically, and on the increases to existing companies, required that the 20% number be met prior to being able to put any other vehicles on the road. That was February, our February meeting. Now we're 45 days later with a task force recommending that we drop it to 10%. We have a huge number of wheelchair accessible vehicles that are either on order or have been put into place already. So many, in fact, that it's hard to actually find one on the West Coast to purchase to put into service. But in regards to the 20% accessibility, we're looking at a increase of those types of trips increasing drastically with the baby boomer generation reaching a point in time in their lives where medical problems, disabilities are going to increase probably in the next 10 years. And I would love to see us plan for that rather than being reactive and having a knee-jerk reaction to what's happening now, look down the road and say, we are going to have to be prepared for that. In regards to response time to the handicapped accessibility customers, I absolutely agree that there are huge issues in regards to that in the way that we treat it now. I believe that if we can't respond to somebody with a wheelchair van need in the same amount of time that we can any other customer, then we're doing something incorrectly. And over the period of time that we do collect data, I'm hoping that we're keeping that in mind.
Aaron, why don't you get you to wrap up pretty soon?
Absolutely. I'll do as quick as I can here. I'll just jump to the end. I'd like to speak towards current cab driver livability. Right now we have 2,148 permitted drivers for the cab companies in the city of Portland. That's 2,148 family wage jobs. We've seen generations of families in the taxi cab industry, and we've seen those families put kids through college, pay mortgages, live a decent life, and right now it's being threatened. If I could, I did want to mention one thing in regards to the fares. Uber has the ability to subsidize fares and actually give free rides to customers. The cab companies don't have that ability. They can drop a fare down to next to nothing and pay a subsidization of $20 or whatnot. As a matter of fact, yesterday they were offering a $100 spiff if you've got your car inspected by yesterday up in Vancouver. And the $100 spiff would come in the form of $10, or once you did your first 10 trips, you would get the $100. They have those types of things happening all the time. And those are issues that if you have competition that can drop their fares to nothing, it's going to affect the livelihood of the existing industry. So I'll leave you with that. I had more, but I can put it in writing and send it to you.
Please do. I just, in the interest of time, wanted to...
Absolutely. I know that it's running late, but I'll be more than happy to answer any questions or...
Questions?
Derek, can you think of another industry where we limit the number of participants? We don't limit the number of gas stations or restaurants, or even airplane companies for that matter, although, of course, there's all sorts of safety requirements. Is there another industry where we say we will only have X number of participants?
I can't think of something off the top of my head. However, it's historically been done that way in this industry in many jurisdictions, not just Portland. I mean, it's
pattern. Darren, thank you. Please do give us additional testimony in writing, and we won't hold it against you that you reminded the baby boomer members of this council what our senior citizens status
is. I'm there, too.
Thank you very much. Okay, Commissioner, I think you have a couple more folks to call on your invited list. And
we'll is Brooke Steger still here?
Okay. Come on up, please. Good afternoon.
Hello. Commissioners, thank you so much for allowing me to speak today. My name is Brooke Steger. I'm the general manager for this region for Uber Technologies. I'd like to start by thanking the task force for their dedication to this issue. They're all truly remarkable members of the Portland community. I would also like to thank the Mayor Hales and Commissioner Novick for their dedication to the regulatory process, for creating such a remarkable and balanced task force and supporting a process that was both transparent and community-driven. We have a deep appreciation for the task force's time and commitment to the issue of ride-sharing, and especially for the strong recommendations they have presented here today. This is an opportunity to put into place a regulatory framework that works for these emerging new technologies and improve the way Portlanders move around their community. At Uber, we are supportive of reasonable requirements, like these for TNCs or what's otherwise known as transportation network companies. Transportation network companies are separate from taxis and separate from black car, although we might all offer services from A to B. There are fundamental differences between Uber taxi companies and black car or chauffeur providers. And we appreciate regulations that recognize some of those differences, such as we don't want to pick up passengers on the street or wait in taxi zones in front of the Hilton, for example. As the task force has demonstrated, the technology and business model developed by these companies necessitates a new regulatory framework that doesn't necessarily look like the transportation regulations of the last 50 years. I'd like to touch on a few of the basics and benefits that Uber provides for our community. At Uber, we took a simple idea, push a button and get a ride, and leveraged technological advances in order to make that a reality. When you sign up for Uber, it's very simple. You enter your email address, you enter a credit card. We also accept PayPal, Google Wallet, Apple Pay, so there's multiple forms of payment. And you request a ride through a GPS app-based system or any web-based device. You are connected to the nearest driver, and when that ride is accepted, you see the driver's picture, the license plate of the vehicle, and you can track that vehicle as it comes to you. So it provides a very safe and efficient service for riders that are requesting. And at the same time, the driver also knows who that rider is, and they're able to connect with each other through the application via text message or phone using an anonymized phone number so as not to share the driver or rider's private data. After the ride is completed, the rider will receive an email trip receipt with the picture of their driver, with the license plate of the car, a full trip route, and a phone number where they can connect the driver to retrieve the lost item. We also offer very efficient customer support 24 hours a day, typically responding to a request within just a handful of hours. And if something is more urgent, you'll get an almost immediate request. Uber safety is also a top priority. We use a nationally accredited third-party background check provider that has been vetted by multiple jurisdictions throughout this country, including the city of Seattle, the state of California, the state of Illinois, for example. We do a social security trace, do a national sex offender check, and check a local, county, multi-state, and federal criminal databases across the country. These are typically done on an annual basis. Uber also provides end-to-end insurance coverage so that riders are protected from the moment they get in the vehicle to the time that they exit it. We offer $1 million in combined single-limit insurance coverage during that period of time, from the time a driver accepts a ride to the time that the rider gets out of the vehicle. There's also $1 million in underinsured and uninsured motorist coverage. It's important to note that there's also $550,000, of contingent comprehensive collision coverage during that time as well. This is twice what is currently required for Portland taxis. So any rider in an Uber vehicle will have twice the amount of coverage that they would in a taxi here in this city, should these regulations as suggested pass. During the period when the driver has the app on, but before they've accepted a ride, we offer 50, 125 in coverage, so $50,000 per individual involved in an accident or $100,000 total. This is twice what is the state requirement for personal insurance. And it's important to know the difference between the Uber platform and a taxi. When you're in an Uber, when you're driving and you're an Uber partner and you're driving a vehicle, you're not cruising the streets looking for a trip. You might be at a cafe, you might be at home, or you might be driving across town. The other day I was in a suburb and someone picked me up. They were on the way to a grocery store and dropped me off, and then continued on with their errands. And I think it's very important we recognize this fundamental difference and ensure there's always insurance coverage. However, recognize that people are utilizing the platform in different ways. There's additional benefits that Uber brings, such as serving underserved communities. Over 60% of trips happening in the Northwest are actually replacing personal vehicle trips. We see a huge usage of the platform to complete that last mile after public transit is used. We also offer Uber Pedal and Uber Pool in various cities, which increases commutes and ride sharing. Finally, I would like to announce that we have secured a partnership with First Transit in order to offer wheelchair-accessible rides from day one here in Portland, and that is something that we want to continue to grow. I think this is fundamentally a difficult task in order to serve this community, but it's very, very important. And we've been reaching out and meeting with the community regularly and do understand that this is a very important topic, and we do want to provide equal access and a reliable ride for everyone in the city when and where they need it. I think our partnership with First Transit is just the beginning. We would like to also open that invitation to all of the wheelchair-accessible taxis here in the city to put them on our platform so that all riders can enjoy that trackability, that accountability with that. And we actually open that invitation to anyone who has a wheelchair-accessible vehicle that will meet commercial requirements or meet requirements. Safety requirements, and have them on the platform. We are definitely committed to providing safe and affordable rides to everyone in this community, and we look forward to working with the community. And it's my belief that we can't accomplish that unless we do work together on this task. It shouldn't be one company versus another when it comes to the accessibility services. We should all work together to provide that service because it is so important. And some of the stories that I have heard are extremely concerning. We would like to, finally, I did want to touch on the opportunity that is made available to drivers. It's something that's been discussed here. As the general manager for the Pacific Northwest and someone that's someone who's overseen Seattle for many years, I've not seen the concerns pop up in Seattle. In fact, we continue to offer opportunity to multiple people, be it a single mom, someone that has recently lost their job, a taxi driver looking for additional income. There are multi-channels. The other day I met with Elizabeth, who is an immigrant driver, and she made her first trip home to Ethiopia in over 5 years. She was previously working different jobs and struggling to find reliable income. And with the Uber platform, she was able to take advantage of that and make her first trip home to Ethiopia after moving here, which I found remarkable. Another woman that I was speaking to last week is a spouse of someone that's in the military. She has struggled so much because they've moved around a lot. Her first and foremost job is taking care of her children, and they've struggled with finding additional income, and she struggled with finding regular work. The flexibility of the Uber platform, remember that there is no set hours that a driver has to work. There's no minimum that they have to be on the active on the platform in order to stay active on the platform. She's found the flexibility of that platform amazing and was able to take her children on a vacation for the first time in over 3 years. And that was I found it to be a very moving story. And we see these stories across the board, and we would like to bring those here to Portland. We've seen hundreds of drivers express interest in being partners on our platform, and I really think that there is a lot of potential here and that there is tons of demand and for everyone, and that we should be competing on safety standards and service and offering that opportunity to everyone. Thanks again to the task force for all of the hard work, and we definitely support the recommendations that came through and look forward to working with all of you moving forward.
Thank you. Questions?
There was a suggestion made about...
There you go.
A suggestion made that in order to sort of level the playing field during this 120-day period, that Uber put a cap on the number of drivers it may have during any time period of day, let's say, you know, Saturday nights from 10 to 2 a.m., you would, you know, have no more than X number of drivers accessing your app. First of all, I guess, A, is that doable? And B, what's your thought on that?
Sure. So that's something that we would not support. The variance in supply and demand is very interesting, but it varies quite a bit. So whether there's a Blazers game or a Timbers game or it's 10 a.m. on a Tuesday, I think setting an arbitrary cap, even if it is variable depending maybe on a Friday night to a Tuesday night, is extremely challenging. And all that we're doing is going backwards in our choice of regulation. I think looking forward and figuring out how we can change the entire industry to allow for the supply and demand curve to be met is the most important thing. I supplied during my task force, during our task force presentation, we actually supplied a graph of total drivers online to total requests in Seattle for one day over a 24-hour period, and you'll see that they actually track each other. And I think that that's very important that the system is flexible so that we can meet that demand. Or should New Year's Eve come along, for example, there's going to be a huge amount of demand. And I think it's more important that we get people home safe than protect an existing industry.
And does Uber have the ability to set such a cap, though?
That is not currently built into the technology platform. And I will say that there has been suggestions of that type of system happening. It did, for example, in Seattle, and the council actually then voted to repeal it.
We're certainly more enlightened than our Seattle counterparts.
That's setting the bar.
We'll just put that in the record. I have a number of questions, and thanks for being here and sharing your perspective. So I pulled a copy of the user agreement off the internet, but the one I have is for California. Do you have a draft of the one you intend to use here in Oregon?
I don't have one with me right now, but we're happy to supply that to
you. Thank you. And I don't know whether it's – I'm assuming the boilerplate stuff is probably the same, but we can compare it. But there are a couple things in here, and I know you're not the lawyer here talking about this, so if any of these questions – are questions you'd rather respond to in writing, I'd be fine with that. But there's a couple of things in the user agreement that seemed inconsistent with some of the stated values of your company. So you've stated, and I think correctly, a commitment to safety and to the safety of riders. The disclaimer in the California user agreement says Uber does not guarantee the quality, suitability, safety, or the ability of third-party providers. That seems inconsistent. How do you square that?
Sure. You know, I think that that part of the agreement is very standard across most technology agreements that you will sign. I'm happy to provide a more in-depth analysis of that particular statement from our legal team. I can also say that in that agreement, I do believe that there's also a clause that any state or local law does not supersede or will supersede what that says. So any regulations that are put in place that are were required to follow will trump whatever is in a user agreement, and as well as an insurance policy. So we would have that $1 million of insurance in place, that will trump that statement.
Right. There's another clause in here that requires that in the event of a dispute, an aggrieved party must go through arbitration, which is the only recourse, and there's limits on people's rights of recovery in arbitration. I know that's also becoming more standard in industry. Why does Uber think that's an appropriate way to resolve disputes?
That's something I'll have to have our legal department who wrote that get back to you on, because it's not something I've actually experienced in my time working at Uber.
The next question has to do with what's been a big topic of conversation at this really outstanding, very, informative and thoughtful hearing, which is how we address customers that have a disability. And we're coming up on a major anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it was a piece of, it was a law in 1990 that, as you know, literally changed the world. And yet in every single case I could find involving Uber in litigation, Uber takes the position that Title III of the ADA does not apply to the company. And I don't understand why that is. I've read Title III. Title III has specific statutory language. The Justice Department of the United States has weighed in a number of cases and said they disagree with Uber on that. And the concern that I have is if your company continues to take the position you're not covered by the Americans with Disabilities Act, it undermines my confidence that we're going to get some of these other issues right. Do you have an official position on this, or do you want to get back to us in writing?
I mean, in terms of the legal language of the Americans with Disabilities Act,
Uber says it does not apply.
I would have to have my legal team, but I can speak for what we've done here in the Pacific Northwest and the riders that I've seen and what we announced and what we've been working on here. So first and foremost, we let drivers know that they are required to follow the Americans with Disabilities Act. We do partner with a variety of different types of drivers. UberX, which we are discussing here today, is just one of them. We also partner with taxi companies throughout the country. We partner with licensed limousine providers throughout the country. So it does vary, but we do inform drivers that they have to comply with the ADA Act. We also have very strict requirements and support all of the non-discrimination policies that were proposed by the task force. Should we get a report that, for example, a seeing eye dog, someone with a seeing eye dog was denied because they had a seeing eye dog, that would be grounds for an end in our partnership with that particular driver, as well as our app is optimized for voiceover.
If the company continues to take the position that as a company, you're not bound by Title III of the ADA, would you consider a requirement that all of your drivers get a specific training in the legal requirements under all applicable provisions of the ADA rather than simply notifying them that it's the governing law?
I do believe that there is a training program that was requested by the task force, and in my understanding, there are a series of questions and topics that will actually be provided by the City of Portland in order to cover with the driver, and so I think that that's a definite possibility. We already do provide, we have training emails and videos that address guide dogs, identifying people who are vision impaired, and so on and so forth. And I also believe that we're fully committed to serving the accessible community here and are going to work very hard at that. We also have Uber Assist in some of our markets, which actually comprises a series of in-person training for people. It still uses typical UberX vehicles, but those drivers receive additional in-person training to help people with a walker or that are in a folding wheelchair, someone that does have a seeing eye dog, if they need extra assistance to help them get into the vehicle safely. And that's something that we've committed to launching here in Portland, probably not at the time of launch, but something that we would like to roll out locally.
Might I jump in on that with one more question on accessibility, if you were going to leave that topic, and that is, could you maybe elaborate just a little bit more on how this relationship with First Transit would work in practice? So I'm a disabled Portlander. I need an accessible vehicle.
Sure.
I access the app and request a ride. Where does First Transit come in? How?
Sure.
What do they do?
So I think fundamentally how it'll work is exactly the same as every other vehicle. So we would issue either a phone to First Transit or to the drivers that we're partnering with on First Transit, or they could use their personal phone if it was supported. Otherwise, we can issue them one. When they were available to drive, they would simply indicate that they were available. Someone requests, they would get that request, accept it, and the individual that requested would be able to see the make and the model of the vehicle, a picture of the driver, and track that vehicle coming to them, and they would tell the driver where they wanted to go and get out of the vehicle just like every other rider. I do believe, though, that this partnership with First Transit is really just the beginning. It's been very clear, I think, from everyone's testimony that this problem is very complex, and I do believe that it'll take multiple partners in order to provide adequate service.
And to follow up on the mayor's question, will you commit that the disabled customer who is accessing, for whom you're dispatching through First Transit, will pay the same fare as a non-disabled passenger?
That's correct. Yes.
No change.
No change.
You've heard a lot in our discussion today about the enforcement piece of the recommendations, and the enforcement piece turns in part on getting good data from taxi companies and TNCs so that we can assess within the 120-day period. Commissioner Novick hopes to have some further regulations at the end of that. Have you had a chance to review the data request component of this report?
Yes.
And does Uber have any objections to the categories of data that that we would be requesting?
I think the most important thing is how that data is transferred. We have an agreement, for example, with the city of Boston, where we enter into a contract in order to protect the confidentiality of that data. So first and foremost, any personally identifiable data, which I believe we avoid in that, is our top concern. But secondarily, as we will have competitors should we enter this market, we want to make sure that the data we're supplying is kept confidential, though we do want to supply data to help the city better plan their transportation systems and also plan their accessibility systems.
Because that component is so fundamental to the recommendations, I think it would be helpful that pieces of the deal you struck with either Boston, New York, or some other jurisdiction, which you think would be essential components of our request for data, that you let us know before next week.
Absolutely.
And if there are specific issues around proprietary information, confidentiality, privacy, or any other claim that you might have with that data, that you green light that for us so that we know whether this is going to be, just an administrative matter and working that out, or whether we have a fundamental disagreement.
I believe that we can absolutely find common ground, because I think the goal is the same. It's to benefit the city of Portland, and we want to provide data that does that. So we'll be very transparent in what
Is there any of the data that they've suggested we collect that you can't actually collect?
Not that I'm aware of.
Separate and apart from whether you want to provide it.
Not that I'm aware of.
And then you mentioned you have a third-party background check company you're using. Who is that?
Currently, we use a company called Hirees, which is their accredited large-scale background check provider checking county, multi-state, and federal criminal background checks.
What's the name of it again?
Hirees.
Hirees?
Mm-hmm. A national company?
It's a national company with a national accreditation. I believe it's like a BSCC accreditation. That's a third party issues an accreditation. They go in and vet the background check provider to ensure that they're meeting the standards. And in fact, we track which taxi drivers come onto our platform by using a for-hire license in Seattle, and we deny approximately 8 to 10% of them. So we stand firmly behind our background check process. We feel that it's very good and better than the services being offered at the city of Seattle.
Good. Thank you very much.
Are you able to get data from Wyoming?
I'm not exactly sure. We're currently not operational in Wyoming. But I believe that it's 50 state. And so I've never heard that caveat about Wyoming before. So I think that's something we'll have to look into.
So is Uber willing to supply drivers' names, driver's license numbers, and vehicle license numbers?
Typically, as an audit provision, we offer a full list of all of the last, or what we would like to propose as an auditing provision, is we'll offer a list of the last 5 digits of the driver's license number, and that the city can then choose which drivers they would like to audit from that list and pull which, and pull their vehicle inspection, driver's license, et cetera. Additionally, each driver will, of course, have to get a business license here in the city to operate.
So are you willing to, is Uber willing to have only permitted drivers have access to the platform?
In what form?
Do you have to have a permit before you can sign up for the app to be a driver?
That depends on which jurisdiction that we're operational in. There, in many cases, we are permitted as a TNC, and so that's the requirement. There's absolutely no driver that's allowed onto the platform that hasn't gone through a background check, a vehicle inspection. We also collect their driver's license, their registration of their vehicle, and their insurance. And if those any of those documents expire, they are immediately removed from the platform.
So there's a media report that Houston has issued 741 citations since January for drivers driving without a permit. Given what you just said, how could that happen?
I'm actually not familiar with the operations of the City of Houston as a company. I operate the Pacific Northwest, and I can tell you that there in the City of Seattle, there has been no citations issued. Obviously, when a city is getting up, if there are no regulations in place, such as in Portland, there may be disputing issues there. But I can say that, for example, in the City of Seattle, we worked very hard and long to pass regulations there. Regulations were passed after about a year and a half, and we are 100% compliant with the regulations, as we are with the City of Tacoma. That's something I take a lot of pride in, is making sure that we are working closely with the city, making sure that we are following the regulations that were put into place. And that's a huge priority for me. And so I would say if there were regulations such as what the task force passed here in the City of Portland, we would make 100% sure that every driver was compliant and that we were compliant. And I would also ask that the city go through auditing measures and to ensure that we are compliant.
Well, I was asking about everyone. So are you willing to, is Uber willing to have the driver have to have a business license that the number is available before allowing them access to the platform?
Every driver is running their own business, and they should have a business license. I don't think we're questioning the fact that there is a law here. And
that's what we were referencing earlier, right, that we found with Airbnb, we have a 95% non-compliance rate. So we need to get ahead of that before we allow this.
I think that the most we prefer to not, just as if we issue the partner drivers on our system 1099s, we would prefer that the business license be dealt with between the driver and the city. However,
how would we know that when we don't know who the drivers are?
They would have to apply with they have to apply for a business license with the city.
Right, but if we don't know who they are, because Uber is not going to tell us, so we're not going to know that they haven't applied for a business license.
Well, there's multiple ways, I believe, of checking, right? So if we issued you we issued you a list of the last 5 digits of the driver's license number in order to protect. We also want to make sure that that list is protected. You come back to us and take a statistical significant amount of drivers from that list and ask for their information. Then we would provide under some confidentiality, we would like that information to remain confidential, but we would provide their documents. You could then go check to make sure that they have a business license. Or if you're going and doing spot checks, like you request a vehicle, I believe in the recommendations it did ask that the driver make their business license number available at the request of an enforcement agent. So I believe that you can easily.
But Brooke, in fairness, this is shades of short-term rentals. Because you're the platform, you're actually in the best position to fulfill what you just said earlier, which is the great pride you take in ensuring that you are in compliance with all local rules and regulations, and that is not to allow someone on your platform if they have not, to your satisfaction, established that they have the legal right to participate. And while we can add lots of staff people and create all kinds of regulatory hoops, it's much easier, actually, if we got a commitment from the platform that you're going to verify that someone has applied for a business license, is otherwise licensed, insured, and everything else, before you put them on your platform, because by putting them on your platform, you're giving them the good housekeeping seal of approval, at least from Uber's point of view, notwithstanding your disclaimers. You're essentially telling me or my daughter as a customer that this is someone that we could take a car ride with.
So isn't
the easiest thing to do just to have you commit that you won't put people on your platform and don't do business with people that are out of compliance with our laws?
I absolutely agree with you. I think that when it comes to safety measures, maybe I think the only thing that's up for question here is the business license, but definitely with a vehicle inspection, with a background check, with their vehicle registration, their driver's license, their insurance, those are fundamental to safety, and those are things that we absolutely check for prior to any driver becoming on the platform. And I think we can have a further discussion about the business license.
Keep in mind, we typically deal with companies, and that's how we get compliance. Uber and other companies like yours have taken the position that the people that you work with are independent contractors. Now a court will someday in the future, a court will decide that question about what their status is. But you treat them as independent contractors, which means that obligation is shifted to the individual drivers. We don't want to create a lot of regulatory headaches for the city or for you, but it just seems to me that we ought to be able to agree on a series of criteria that you could help us enforce by making sure that anyone you give the privilege to be on your platform meets our minimum requirements.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think that that's happened in many jurisdictions. For example, in the state of California, it is the TNC that is licensed. We are required to ensure that every driver that is on the platform go through that vehicle inspection, be conducted through that background check. So I absolutely think that you're right, and I think that we can find a very common ground to ensure public safety as well as put the onus of compliance on us while proving to you that we are compliant, and so are the drivers on the platform.
How do we the task force talks about trust but verify. How do we verify that you've done the background checks, that you've done the safety inspections?
Absolutely. So first and foremost, I think I would want the City of Portland to look at our background check provider, the city, and as well as our insurance. So the City of Seattle has vetted both our background check provider, for example, and had a risk manager go through our insurance policy to ensure that it meets safety standards. Secondary to ensure, for example, how do we know that drivers are going through the required vehicle inspections that the city is mandating? Again, what we would do is we would supply a list of the last five digits of each driver's license number of each driver that's on the platform. The city could then select a subset, a statistically significant subset of those drivers, and check and request those documents. So therefore, you are choosing the drivers that you're checking. It's not us deciding that we're going to turn over these 20 drivers' documents to you in order for you to check. You are picking the drivers. You'll verify that their driver's license number, in fact, does match the list provided. And then we'll also be able to provide the background check, the vehicle inspection. You can check those. In addition, you can also have people on the street requesting a vehicle and requesting the documents of the driver that you actually get in the vehicle with from us.
Brooke, has Uber made a commitment that it will not reenter the Portland market until such time as this council authorizes them to be here?
I see Steve Novick smiling. we at this point,
it could be a yes or no.
We will wait to reenter the market until there are regulations in place. I do ask the council that this happen sooner rather than later. We have a series of drivers that are driving currently in the surrounding areas. Over 30% of the trips are dropping off in Portland, so there's, in fact, vehicles on the streets now. They're just only able to drop off. There's a lot. We're seeing tens of thousands of attempted requests every month. And right now we're leaving people hanging without a trip, and we're impacting the earnings of these drivers. And so I think it's very important that we get this done quickly, but we will not be launching until something is passed through this council.
Thank you.
Brooke, I can't believe Commissioner Fritz hasn't already asked you this question, but on her concern about insurance companies canceling personal policies because a driver is acting as an Uber or other TNC driver, it seems to me that there might be a couple of ways to address that concern. One would be to require that anybody who's permitted as a TNC driver provide something signed from their insurance company says, I know this person is an Uber driver and we're not canceling their personal insurance when they're not on the app. Another might be for Uber to say that, to contract with the city that if anybody has a claim against an Uber driver, which is denied because the insurance company wouldn't cover them, then Uber will step in and make the appropriate payments. What do you think about those ideas?
I think that the second concept. There is absolutely no time when we wish that there is any driver without insurance on the road. And I believe that the policy and the compromise, I don't know if you are aware, but there has been a national compromise with insurance companies made that is currently in going through legislation in multiple jurisdictions. And other companies are beginning to offer coverage that not only says it's okay if you're a TNC driver and Uber is providing the coverage from periods 1, 2, and 3, but they're also explicitly coming out with policies that cover that period 1 app-on. So Metro Mile, for example, and USAA have all come out with policies that do cover that, and they are not. There is a process you have to go through in the state of Oregon as part of this national insurance agreement. They're all state. I believe State Farm, PCI, Lyft, and Uber are all part of this, and we have agreed, you know, that this is an important market and that it's not just Uber and Lyft playing in the sharing economy where people are logged in and driving around using their personal resources in order to make additional income. And I think it is important that the insurance companies catch up. So I would offer that should that ever happen, which it's never happened in the case of any of my markets, that we would absolutely reach out and ensure that there was coverage provided.
Have any private insurance companies applied in the state of Oregon to provide this period one coverage?
Not that I am aware of. But again, we have period one coverage that would apply here, and which would cover that period one time until these private insurers started bringing coverage here. And again, there is not a ton of business currently in the state of Oregon, and I believe as the business expanded here, insurance companies would start offering those products.
Commissioner, I just want to be clear. It's not the period of time, even 1, 2, or 3. It's that if you're using your private vehicle for commercial purposes, you may lose your entire family's coverage from your private. And so they are in progress, but why we would move forward with a trial and put our citizens at risk is beyond me.
Brooke, how do you respond to concerns some people have raised about your business model that requires that someone has a smartphone and a debit card? And to the extent there's a class of people that cannot use this service because of that business model. And I'll give you an example. I was in San Francisco recently, and probably because of all this competition, Yellow Cab has a service that's now much easier to use. And you can call, get in the queue, and it'll dispatch cabs when you need it. And they alert you when the cab is there. They recognize who's calling once you've made the first call, so it's personalized. And I'm guessing all that's a result of competition. But the difference was a Yellow Cab came to wherever I was, and I could pay cash. Your business model doesn't allow that. So what does Uber say to the class of customers, potential customers out there, that would be disqualified because they don't have a smartphone and they don't have access to a debit card or a credit card?
Sure. So you don't need a smartphone. You can also request via a computer. And I believe that I was looking up stats on the Portland government's website, and I believe 96% of people here have access to the internet. And I believe that the internet is a fundamental resource that everyone should have access to.
Portland?
Mm-hmm.
I think you're probably, that's probably a very generous number. It may include, you know, being within a half mile of a library.
But, okay.
Because we actually have a digital divide that Commissioner Salton is trying to tackle, but whatever the number.
Okay, great. Yeah, and again, you could absolutely request an Uber from a library should you require
that. What about the payment?
And then with the payment, we require, it's not just debit card or credit card, but it's also PayPal, Google Wallet, and Apple Pay. We do not accept cash. That is true.
Because?
Our platform is fully digital, and I believe that in many ways, a lot of the drivers that we've seen come over from other previous systems express the fact that there is no cash exchange in the vehicle, and the fact that the driver is not carrying a large sum of cash protects that driver on many different levels. And so I think we haven't seen a lot of requests for cash either. And because it is an online digital platform, and because that idea of being cashless in the vehicle does provide such high levels of protection for the rider and the driver, it's not something that we've considered here in the Northwest.
Well, since you mentioned protection for the driver and the customer, what about the most recent breach of data? the 50,000 customers that had some of their data breached and the potential vulnerability to your platform?
I think that's something that we can send you information on. I am not readily familiar with the ins and outs of that, of the data breach and what occurred. And so I think that that's something we can supply you with more information on because I'm not knowledgeable enough to speak on it.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. I think you have one more invited.
Annabelle Chang from Lyft.
Annabelle Chang from Lyft.